Hello and welcome to Pitch and Play, a podcast about actually playing the games that your friends tell you to. My name is Cassie.
And my name is Ross.
And we have a very special person with us right now, known by name only and now by voice.
Hi, I'm Joe.
Joe is my boyfriend. God, I hate that word. Joe is my boyfriend.
Because I'm your partner.
Because I'm 13.
That's how adults speak.
I'm your partner. I don't like partner either. This is an off microphone conversation to have.
Okay.
Joe is my boyfriend, and he's a big Zelda fan. And every time we talk about Zelda, we're like, "Wow, we should really have Joe here with us to elucidate on Zelda." And Joe is here to elucidate.
I love that the stipulation for really, really liking Zelda is liking it more than Cassie.
Well, that but you're bomb. Also a big. You're a big Breath of the Wild fan, which we cannot say of either me or Ross. So you can sit here and defend Breath of the Wild to us. So we are completely breaking the formula of our podcast that we established over 9 episodes because it's our podcast and we make the rules. We are going to talk more about The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. We talked like very, very early impressions last time, and now each of us has played more of it. I would assume if you're trying to avoid spoilers for this game, maybe don't listen to any of it because like the nature of this game, not that I mean, I value you and appreciate you. Please listen to our podcast. But also like the nature of this game is such that like everybody has done something different. So spoilers are kind of a weird territory. So I don't know. I think we can avoid like out and out spoilers, but we can talk.
I don't need to just like lay out the plot points and ruin this game for anyone.
Yeah.
But also you can play 30 hours of this game and not touch some of the things that other people have done.
Joe played 10 hours of this game and didn't pick up a fucking paraglider. So
some of these shrines were difficult without the paraglider. Some of them not possible, but others doable, just really unnecessarily difficult.
So you did a challenge run unexpectedly.
I told myself, how long can I play this game without getting into any of the story bits? I did go to Lookout Landing initially, but didn't go back and activate the towers. So like I saw you get to Hyrule Castle and you get that one scene where Zelda like looks at you and then disappears into the sky and flies away. And then you're supposed to go back to Lookout Landing immediately. And I spawned in a wing and flew as far away as I could and then started doing stuff. Didn't work out well. It was fun, but difficult.
Yeah. So we will try to have a semi-structured conversation about Tears of the Kingdom. And then we will talk about, I haven't played any more Dragon Age, so we're not going to talk about Dragon Age, sorry. And then we'll do our pitch. Yeah, well, okay, here's the thing. Dragon Age is, I would say, a game I have to dedicate a lot of mental energy to. And recently, in my work, I have had to dedicate a lot of mental energy and anguish and I don't come home and want to play Dragon Age. I come home and want to play Zelda because right now Zelda is bringing me joy.
Ooh.
So let's start. Let's recap a little bit about Breath of the Wild. So Ross, you and I talked about Breath of the Wild.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about our various issues with Breath of the Wild. My mm-hmm. issue, I would say primarily with Breath of the Wild, I would say there are two. One, the story, that it's Zelda's story, but she's not in it. And like the story is very light. And secondly, I fucking hate the shrines. And I did all of them, so I'm allowed to say that.
I think I did a third of them, at least.
A third? You didn't do all the shrines in Breath of the Wild?
No, for you.
Oh, okay. All right. That's different. Ross, what were your issues with Breath of the Wild? Because you were also quite critical of it.
Yeah, my issues were largely on the weapon degradation system and the mm-hmm. limited modes of exploration. Your ability to move about the environment was extremely limited, so I hated that.
I remember very clearly you complaining about everything as just climb this mountain, then paraglide, then climb this mountain, then paraglide.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy climbing mountains and paragliding down. However, The horse system is fun. You can also, with the DLC, you can get a motorcycle, which is very fun. Spawn that in wherever you want and ride up mountains and then paraglide off. Or just ride up a mountain and fly off.
It's probably important to specify, though, it takes a long time to get that motorcycle.
Yeah, you need to get the Divine Beasts finished first and then do an entire DLC.
So, Joe, in, let's say, 2 minutes or less, can you defend Breath of the Wild to us, please?
This seems a little
unfair. What am I defending it against?
Just tell it, like, what is it? Because you play Breath of the Wild, I would say, near constantly. What is it you like about Breath of the Wild?
I like the experience. I like the running around. I like to do those dumb puzzles and see how to like break the game in different ways, because that, like, the physics system within that game allows you to complete shrines in incredibly wrong ways and just like get around in really dumb, incorrect ways that they just like weren't anticipating, but it just works out.
Okay. That is what you love about Breath of the Wild.
Sure.
Okay.
I like the outfits.
Yeah, I do like the outfits.
I like the Divine Beasts. I know people weren't happy with them as the temples, but I enjoyed doing them. I won't say that they compare very well to, or very directly to, temples necessarily, but they were what people pointed at as like, these are the four major temples. And it was clearly trying to be something else. I would say Tears of the Kingdom definitely went more directly, we're going to make temples this time. Mm-hmm. And even some of them don't quite feel like the traditional temples, although the Gerudo one definitely feels most traditional in that way.
Okay. Okay. So can we do a little check-in of like where kind of we are at with Tears of the Kingdom? Mm-hmm. And I know that that's hard to do, but I guess I'll start and model for you all. I have done, I would say, probably like 20 or 30 shrines. Probably closer to 20. I'd say I've probably done about 20 shrines. I have done all the towers at this point. I've unlocked all the towers. And I have done the Gerudo storyline.
Is that all you've done?
Well, I've done a lot of running around is the thing.
Okay.
I very much was just like, because like I went to like the, like I went to Hateno and Kakariko and like did all of the, I went to Tarrytown. Like I was very much about like, let me just like go to places and like run around. I don't know. That's what I like doing. And then it was only today that I kind of started with the Gerudo stuff, but I've like been everywhere, I would say.
Okay. Then I will say that I've unlocked every tower. I've done the whole of the Dragon's Tears questline to the end.
Okay.
Side quest. It is a main quest, actually. Mm-hmm. I have done probably the same amount of shrines. I have done quite a bit of the depths. And I have
pretty much...
Yeah, that's what I was sort of alluding to.
A lot of time in the depths. Yes, yeah. I have been in the depths.
We've all been in the depths.
that's kind of the description for the last couple of years. We've all just been in the depths.
But I've done a lot of the Sky Islands too. Not like the highest ones, but pretty much everything you can glide to from a tower. Yeah, and side quests here and there, really.
Okay, Joe, where are you at?
So I just went to a loading screen so that I could screenshot what I have accomplished. I don't know what all these symbols mean.
Yeah, there are two symbols on that screen that I look like. I assume are shrines, one of them, but I
don't
know.
One of them's
a
shrine and one of them is a light root. And I think I have 93 shrines and 87 light roots.
You've been busy.
I've been a little busy.
How many roots?
87.
Okay.
What do you know about the depths, by the way? It took a bit to realize that it is like this is a mirrored surface, and those light roots are just roots from the shrines, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been really nice because I've been using the shrines to find light roots, and then light roots to find shrines.
Yeah, it's a great system.
It really is. It's been a lot of fun.
So let's talk about the depths, because I think that's a good place to start. And I think it's kind of wild that like the depths are such a big part of this game, given that the marketing for this game was very much focused on the like you can drop from the sky.
Yeah,
the depths are insane I love the deaths. And I don't know if this is like, and Joe can attest to this, that like, I am a mole person, I think. In every video game that I play, Stardew Valley, Minecraft, I'm always like, I'm going to dig a hole. I want to be underground. Zelda was kind of no exception, because very early on, they point you to going into the depths to get the camera. And I just like went down in the depths and stayed in the depths and like ran around a lot. The depths are dope. I love the depths.
The depths are very cool. I will say, I finally got the paraglider. I went back and got the paraglider after I attempted to jump into a chasm. Specifically, it was the Minish chasm. And I was so excited. I was like, what could this possibly mean? Am I about to jump into a chasm that's going to lead me to the Minish woods? I thought I was going to deal with a bunch of little folks and all of that. That was just the name of the woods that the chasm was in. But still, I tried to jump in that and died. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, it's time to get the paraglider. Went back and got that. Still never got the camera until like a couple days ago.
The fuse power also took you a long time to get.
The auto build one.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Auto build. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But now I have done all of that side quest with the Master Koga or whatever.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm just like, I'm kind of like overwhelmed by how much there is in this game. Like, it truly feels like I could spend a year playing this game.
That's kind of the goal.
Yeah, which is kind of phenomenal. It makes it hard to talk about, though. So the depths.
The depths, it never rains. You don't have to slip.
That's true. One of our complaints, Ross, in talking about Breath of the Wild was that we hated the fucking rain. And the depths, there's no rain. It does present its own challenges for like traversing the depths. But like for people who, I don't know, have somehow never played this game and haven't seen anything about it, the depths is like the underground.
We have to be somewhat like spoilerific about it. We can't be this like eggshell stepping.
So the premise of the game that like this is starting off is that Hyrule Castle, you and Zelda were down there. Some bad shit went down and Zelda was basically sent to the past. I don't feel that that's a big spoiler because that happens like early hours of the game.
Yeah, pretty much told that within 5 hours. So I think everyone knows it.
Yeah, Link is very badly injured. He gets the arm of King Rauru, who was like the original king of Hyrule and like formed the country or whatever the hell it is. Link gets this arm that has special new powers. And at this event, they call it the upheaval. Hyrule Castle like raised out of the ground. Is that true?
Yes.
All this shit started falling from the sky and these chasms opened to the underworld. So the chasms, when you go down into them, they're very, I would say, empty in a sense of like they're unexplored and kind of like uncharted territory. Eventually, you find out that there are like these old Zonai mines down there and the Yiga clan has like formed bases. There's all kinds of wild shit down there. There's these Poes that you can collect, which are like wandering spirits, sort of, that you can then exchange for clothing. That's a little strange, but I do enjoy collecting those Poes. And like, I don't know, it's just like, there is still that feeling of compelling exploration and adventure in the main world, but the main world is largely... I don't want to say this as a derogatory. The main world is an asset flip of Breath of the Wild, right? There are definitely things that have changed. There are things that are different, but it is still that world. Whereas the underground, I don't know. I think it's kind of scratching that itch for me for exploration because I'm like, I don't know what's down here. Like, I know if I go to this area in the overworld, I'm going to come to Hateno Village and there's going to be new things to do in Hateno Village. Hateno Village is going to be different in a lot of ways, but the underground, it has that possibility of like, I don't know what I'm going to find. This is exciting. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, the depths have been very good. There is such a satisfying thing of just gathering those Poes. Mm-hmm. Even if I have thousands and nothing to spend them on. Because like at this point, yeah, all the clothes are, you know, a couple hundred. And I just have to find more of those bargainer statues to be able to spend more of them. I'm like, I still want to, every time I see one, I'll fly over there to get one single regular Poe. It's very satisfying.
It's one of those aspects which... You say that the overworld is more like an acid flip of Breath of the Wild, and it is for sure. And they've definitely changed up a number of the key areas enough that it feels fairly fresh-ish, or at least it plays on that whole nostalgia of, I remember this area, oh, it's changed a bit. Oh, look, these characters are sort of here, but different. So you get that sense of history if you played Breath of the Wild, but at the same time, it's still accessible for new players. It's not totally overwhelming, the changes, so it's impenetrable. Whilst, the depths, I would say, is very much like It's its own sort of asset flip's the wrong word. Low, it's not low effort, but like they didn't need to invest so much in making this very different world. You know, they didn't have to make something like the overworld of Breath of the Wild, where, you know, bits of desert, bits of like icy mountains, there's all of this aspect. They just had to make, here's a pit with a load of hazards and monsters, and there's very few quests, and that's really it. So really, it was a simplistic vision compared to the overworld, but that gave it its strength, because you know what you're getting when you go down to the depths. Once you start learning what's there, you're like, okay, there's more of this. But there are occasional surprises here and there, but nothing too much where it's like, oh, I have to change how I play this like underground area. And they even do some interesting things, which I'm not going to spoil because I don't think either of you got to it by what you mentioned. There are aspects where you interact, like you were saying with the light routes and the shrines, they interact with each other. There are more aspects of the depths and the overworld interacting with each other than you would initially think, to the point of like, yeah, the map is.
Are we talking about the statues?
And not just the statues. I mean, literally like the interaction between thing you, well, sort of like that, but that's what I'm saying as well. There's like depth to that. And I don't want to spoil it because I think some of it's quite cool to discover and some of it is, I think, part of quests, but I did them in a weird order, so I won't spoil. But yeah, like, there's just aspects that you're, like, you get familiar with the depths probably quicker than you're expecting to, because at first it's intimidating as hell to be down there and be like, I can't see anything. That's the really unique bit about this area. Everything is total black. The lighting is, like, so dim that maybe you can make out the gloom and maybe, like, far off light-ish, but realistically, you don't have much to go on. So you just pick a direction, and you don't have, like, towers. This was the other interesting thing as well. So you pick towers on the overworld to reveal sections of map, and that will reveal a whole region, and you will get pretty, like, in detail, like, what's there. But you don't have towers underground. You only have the light routes, which are the shrine equivalents. So you're actually progressing at a slower pace to reveal the map, which also makes it feel even bigger because you're just inching forward to what you can get. And you know that, like, the mystery of, like, finding every corner is going to be even longer if you want to find everything. So it keeps that, like, mystery and all what's around this corner that keeps you compelled to move forward, which, considering what it is, which is really, I don't think, going to be that deep overall, it's really smart, especially because they have to cover the whole area of Hyrule. It's the whole map, basically. And I'm like, they really push to what, like, to compel players to keep playing in the same sized area, which is madness to me.
And I think that's a really interesting point that you brought up too, about how, like, you only reveal a little bit of the map at the time, because last night I did my last tower. So I have the entire map of the, like, main Hyrule, and there's still plenty for me to discover, don't get me wrong, but it feels like that map is a known quantity now, whereas, like, down in the depths, it's like I'm still just, like, inching forward and, like, clawing a way out, that there's this, like, real challenge to it, not just in the sense of, like, you have that map, but also one of the conceits of being in the depths is that there is the gloom that Ross mentioned, and you can get gear that makes you, like, resistant to the gloom, but if you take a hit by an enemy who is, like, infested with the gloom, which is just about anything down there except for the little frog guys,
and the big frog guys,
you permanently, semi-permanently lose that heart until you get to a light route. Like, you can eat food and do whatever you want, you will not get that heart back until you go to a light route. So there is a real, like, challenge to being down there, and, like, sometimes a risk reward element of, like, I've been going for a long time and, like, I'm getting close to this next light route, but, like, can I make it with the number of hearts that I'm down? It's really, really tense, and it's really rewarding.
It's got that whole aspect of, so, buzzword, progression. Oh, no. That I always use. it's the one thing that I always look for in games, but how they've designed those enemy encounters, so, yeah, the enemies down in the depths have gloom about them. So you have, like, bokoblins and other things down there, which usually are on the overworld, but down there have gloom as part of them. So because of that, their attacks, cause you to sort of break hearts so you can't heal them. Now, it's sort of interesting because that is a progression system in my mind that makes you, it's supposed to stop lower level players who like are just starting off with the game not to explore the depths too much, because you know that, I don't know, let's say you start off with like four hearts at a minimum when you go down. If you're starting off with those four hearts, if you even lose one of them, that's a quarter of your health potential gone. Yeah. And those enemies generally down there, they're not light hitters. They pretty much take off a lot after a while. So it's to encourage you probably not to go there until you've leveled up. So the progression that it's promoting is more later level, when you've gained more experience and the combat and stuff and the exploration and other zone-like devices stuff that you pick up.
But I went down there immediately. Like, I immediately spent a ton of time down there.
This is the other thing as well, is I did read this somewhere, which was someone was arguing with themselves, like, so when you upgrade, you either upgrade stamina vessels or heart vessels, just like Breath of the Wild. And the whole argument that they were trying to come up with was, do I pick heart vessels or stamina vessels as part of my progression? Because what's more valuable? And the whole like concept that I was reading from this person was, stamina vessels are if you are comfortable in the world and not, and if you get hit, you don't mind so much, but you are generally able to avoid hitting, whilst the health is more for people who are less confident. And I sort of agree with that in a way, because obviously you're thinking, oh, if I'm going to lose hearts, I should like upgrade myself in that way. But if you're confident enough and you feel like you have the skill, you can just explore that depth still without any real worry. You can just do it. And mentioning the whole Zonai devices thing, the thing that Depths gives you is access to loads of Zonai like equipment and stuff in these small little workshop bits that you stumble on, and they are pretty much everywhere, so you can stumble on them pretty easily. And once you start like building custom vehicles, whether they're flying or like ground-based or anything like that, you're given more chance to experiment with stuff down there than you are anywhere else in the world. So
yes,
you get this sense of accomplishment even more, because you're like, I built this, I got from here to there, and yeah, it just gives you that new, like, yeah, I completed something, which the shrines and stuff give on the overworld, but the underworld is its own little challenge. And like I say, I'm surprised how much depth there is in that.
Yeah.
In the depths. So one thing about the Zonai devices down in the depths is, like, I could see an argument for, okay, these are just these cookie cutter hexagons that are preloaded. So like one area has a bunch of these exact setups over and over again, but they're so cool because now that I finally got that auto build power way too recently, like I can design a device that I can use with this specific cookie cutter setup. And I know I can build that one right away. Versus like, oh, and another one, I can build this more complex thing, or I can build a different machine at a different one. So like I have these setups that I can just pull out right away. And I know, okay, I'm at this one. I know exactly what I can build immediately with it, because it is, here's the exact number of each thing that I know I'll have access to. And then back to the stamina versus hearts. I spent most of the beginning of the game in the sky. Once I got the paraglider, I was up in the Sky Islands a lot more, and I was gliding so much that I maxed out my stamina before I got a single heart upgrade. And
wow.
But that's also how I would play Breath of the Wild too. I love just sprinting everywhere.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm impatient. And also, because of the way both Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom works, if you have max hearts and you get hit with something that would have killed you in one shot, it leaves you with a quarter heart. So I would only have to make four heart meals that I could just eat after I got obliterated, because it would have killed me, but I survived because I only had four hearts. So it was less expensive to cook something to heal me back up.
And see, that's so interesting, because Ross, when you were talking about that difference, that like choice between like heart vessels, stamina, I've been going straight heart vessels this entire time because I have spent so much time in the depths that I'm like, I need those hearts.
Mm-hmm.
The stamina to me has felt so unimportant, and I haven't done a lot of the sky stuff, so that might be part of it. But to me, with the new powers that you have and with the verticality of this game, stamina just has not been important to me. And I think that, Ross, this touches on like one of your complaints with Breath of the Wild so much, that like with Breath of the Wild, I felt compelled to get stamina upgrades because I was like, I want to be able to climb up that thing and be able to get to what's up there. Here, because you have the ascend power, because you're able to build these like insane things that can bring you up places, or you can just shoot up out of a tower and immediately get like some of the height that you need, stamina to me really has not been a constraint. Like, I think I did one or two stamina upgrades just because I was like, yeah, whatever, I know, I might as well. But yeah, I haven't felt that I needed the stamina. And I think that that's so interesting that we have like almost completely opposite experiences with the game. And I think it speaks to like how much there is here to do. And that was true of Breath of the Wild, that like there are so many different play styles that it can cater to. But I think that
this is just so much bigger
and so much more refined in a way that I really appreciate.
Yeah, this is the thing that's always perplexed me so far with playing this game is, you know, how fundamental some design choices change the whole experience of how you play. And it's why I keep mentioning progression throughout every game that we talk about, because progression is the thing that leads players to feel compelled to play by actually introducing them to systems and understanding of how to play the game. Because if you don't like give someone an ability to progress in their skill in the game, you are constraining their creativity and their ability to, you know, make their own choices in a game. Which is why if you're going to constrain stuff, it has to be for a reason. So sort of a thing which I'm slightly surprised about in a way for you, Joe, but the whole idea of you sort of exploring the depths and healing back up. So one of the things with the hearts, actually I know how you got around this probably, which is the sky roots, but one of the things which the game tries to promote is you to leave the depths to do the sky islands to get the sun delions, which are the things which allow you to like repair your hearts and heal back again, because the food won't repair it normally, heal it properly. So they're trying to encourage you to mix and match how you play, because the gloom will give you broken hearts. And if you're in daylight or by sky roots, they'll heal back up, like repair. But you don't want to be like going up to the surface or going back to a sky root and then trying again. It's to give you like that immediate, oh, I took some damage, heal, repair it back up, and then I'll keep going. So it encourages you to go and collect those things. And then when you're obviously collecting, which is a big thing in Breath of the Wild, which is whenever you were aiming to like, I don't know, I'll go over to that building over there and it's a while away. And on the way, you experience three other things and you can easily get distracted. And I think that they knew that a lot more from the design learnings of Breath of the Wild, that they were like, cool, we have three levels to play with. We have the sky, the underground and the overworld. We are going to tell you, the only way that you can experience this game is if you keep going between them. The shrines are where you upgrade, so you need the overworld. Depths don't really give you much, apart from zonite, I suppose, which you then upgrade your energy cells. So everything is so interconnected that it doesn't feel like I'm being compelled to do one thing, which again is how like we can experience things completely differently as well. Because as much as we can go against that grind or whatever the game's trying to tell us, we've been taught how to do these things, and now it's our choice as the player to make what decision we want to, what we want to pursue. And that is, oh God, I sound so preachy, but that is like the fundamental of a good open world like game. You can choose the order of stuff and how you want to approach it, even when you're given all of these options.
And I feel that with this game compared to Breath of the Wild and compared to other open world games is that like at last it feels like the systems have gotten out of my way. That with Breath of the Wild, I felt so bogged down by the Sheikah Slate powers and like just a whole bunch of things that felt like barriers of like, this is the thing I want to be doing, but I have to go and do this other thing so that I can do this thing, so that I can do this thing. And like those threads were very apparent to me. And I think of this with something like Red Dead Redemption 2, that like the systems were always in my way and I didn't want to interact with all those systems. Whereas with this game, it has been so streamlined and simplified into that core building power and the Zonai stuff that like it has all of these, this potential and all of these different threads that you can follow. And it's totally just up to you how you do it and what you do. And it like that never quite clicked with me with Breath of the Wild. Like, I know other people, I know Joe, you've praised that about Breath of the Wild, of like, there's a million different ways to, you know, do this one thing, that it never felt like that with Breath of the Wild to me. With this game, I'm seeing that more, and I'm responding very positively to it.
Are you still resistant to using a lot of those Zoni devices,
though? I'm more willing to. So that's the other thing. It's only the last like day or two that I've really started you, because you can stumble upon these Zoni devices just in the world. Like, there's fans and stuff laying around that you can use to construct this stuff. And usually the ones that you stumble upon within the world are, if they're in the depths, it's to like help you traverse. And if it's out in the world, it's like to get a Korok seed or something. But you also have the Zoni devices in your pockets, and those are a consumable resource. You have to like go to these like gumball machines to get more of them. But you can just like take them out whenever you want and use them whenever you want for whatever you're trying to do. And I did not want to use them early on. I am more willing to now that I think, honestly, now that I think I have spent enough time in the depths where I've kind of been able to play with them freely and not have to feel like I'm spending to get them. That was really where I experimented and kind of figured out, like, how do these two things work together, and what can I build with this, and what can I construct with this, and what do I need to make, you know, what pieces do I need to construct this thing to do this thing that I want to do? I kind of feel like I wrapped my head around that in the depths and in the shrines, and now I'm more willing to utilize that in the overworld when it is costing me.
The shrines having no energy bar to deal with is really, really nice. That was a great way for me to learn how to use those things properly and how to experiment with them. Those shrines, I see what you're doing right there, Ross. Those shrines have been legitimate, great tutorials spread throughout the entire game. Those things have been doing what they were supposed to do in Breath of the Wild that they didn't do as well, where this is actually teaching you how to play the game, and each one is actually teaching you how to do different aspects of the game. Some of them are very explicit, like this is the sneak attack tutorial. Mm-hmm. This is the shoot an arrow while you're in slow-mo tutorial. But some of them are just like, okay, well, here we're going to be focusing on
the fans or the mirrors, or like it shows you. And the mirror one too, because I just did the Gerudo stuff. Like, when you get to the Gerudo town, the shrine that you do in the Gerudo village, which you're compelled to do because it's a pain in the ass to get there, and when you get the shrine you can get the fast travel, so you're like, let me get the shrine right away. It teaches you how to use these mirrors to like direct light, and that becomes like the primary mechanic in the rest of the Gerudo town. So like, that tutorializing and familiarizing you with the mechanics feels so good and so much more well thought out in this game. Joe and I reference this a lot. There's a clip of a streamer who streams Breath of the Wild, like plays hundreds of hours of Breath of the Wild, going into a shrine, and it says like, you can backflip to dodge attacks, and she's like, there's a backflip in this game.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like Breath of the Wild had that, where like you could legitimately not figure out that some of these things exist and you can do them if you just don't take that path. And it feels so much more fluid and natural.
And Tears of the Kingdom still does have like, okay, you don't get the instruction on how to do a specific move until after you've done it. You don't get the like thing in your menu for your special move until after you've done it once. But it does encourage you to actually do them. And it puts you in situations where you should do them, whether it is through Korok seeds pointing you in that direction, or through the shrines, like actually being the training that it's claiming to be.
Yeah, that was literally one of my complaints from the last episode, was the shrines are there, but there is no translation. Breath of the Wild shrines, there is no translation between what you do in them to what you do in the overworld. You are basically in mini games at that point. Whilst, in this, the shrines are giving you the ability to see what you can do with each of these like unique properties. There's ones where how water interacts with lava, how ice interacts with water, how certain objects conduct electricity, and all of these things which were not quite as explicit in Breath of the Wild. And even more so, when you know that you've got these in your pocket and you can just dump them out whenever, if I now see a lava flow or a river, I now can go, okay, I have an ice thing or a electric thing, and I can just throw these down and I know what they'll do. Unlike Breath of the Wild, which was... So, I mean, this Tears of the Kingdom is still a physics-based like puzzle game with its shrines, and it's still largely physics-based. Those physics are mostly informed by how you use parts of these devices or the environment and how they would interact with each other. Whilst, yeah, Breath of the Wild was very much just, here's a funny physics puzzle that sort of sometimes uses the powers, but it doesn't really.
It was that line of, like, I will never have to do this ever again. I just have to do it for this one shrine in Breath of the Wild, and I could become a master of how to operate this stupid-ass apparatus that they have me working with, and then never have to think about it ever again. And that was so frustrating for Breath of the Wild, whereas these, I come into these shrines, and even though some of them have been a little limited, I think, for the sake of tutorial, I at least feel like, oh, I see now, like, that I can use the fan in this way and, like, oh, that will help me later on. Yeah, it all gels together so well.
The one thing I will say about the shrines in Breath of the Wild, while not many of them were actual tutorials and a lot of them didn't directly relate to the overworld, I think part of the reasoning behind that was because there were just these four divine beasts that weren't actually temples. They were looking to just scatter throughout the, like, the type of puzzles that you would potentially be doing in a regular, this type of puzzles you'd potentially be doing in a regular temple, scatter them throughout the entire game instead of having them concentrated in these four areas.
See, but I think that's my frustration. Yeah. I think that's my frustration because, like, they felt like vestiges of old game design that I wish they could just shake off. And I feel like Tears of the Kingdom takes a step away from that.
Well, like, this game has, I think I have done already more blessing shrines than were in the entirety of Breath of the Wild. There are so many.
There's 120 of them in Breath of the Wild.
Blessings. Just by getting into this shrine, you have earned the right to just have this spirit orb. And because a lot of those were, okay, you're up in a sky island, find a way to get the stone over here. Or, yeah, a lot of them honestly were just, you found your way here, or you brought the stone here, which has been cool in its own right. And then, like, that plus a lot of the other shrines within it are these tutorials.
Yeah, and actually sort of to jump off the tutorializing that happens naturally through gameplay, one of the things I found quite interesting after playing a number of them, so you mentioned the Yiga clan, the bad Sheikah people, who, yeah, are just the ninjas of the Zelda setting. They pretty much all are trapped underground, funnily enough, a continuation point of where you finish off Koga in the last game. He just gets plummeted down into the ground, and now you know what he did for all these years. well, actually, not years even, but, you know, all this time.
Yeah, do you have any idea how long is between these two games?
I figured, 10 years.
Oh, no, I would have said a year at best.
Pura goes from a child to a full adult.
Yeah, but she literally says that's experiments to finally turn her back into an adult. She's over 100 years old anyway.
I'm gonna Google this shit.
You can Google it. I honestly don't know.
I guess I was basing that more off of Teba's son, Tulin.
That's a good point. There are a few kids that have grown up.
Is significantly older. All the kids in the Rito Village that you have to do that song quest with are teens at least, fledgling or no longer fledglings. They're able to fly and
A few years probably is more accurate.
I was thinking 3 to 5. Riju is not quite an adult yet, doesn't seem like, but I don't know how old she was in the first place.
I think the thing that weirds me out, I mean, there's a few actual criticisms I'll get to in Tears of the Kingdom eventually, but one of the weird things is, if it is several years, it sounds like Link has never left his home in Hyrule Castle, because everyone's like, oh, hi, whoever you are, or no one recognizes him. And it's like, oh, you sort of remind me of this old swordsman that used to save the kingdom or whatever. I honestly don't know what he's gone up to in that time. But it does feel like stuff has happened and he never left Hyrule Castle, because he's finally stumbling onto, oh, I retired, or, oh, this kid's grown up. And it's like, you have not been around the Hyrule Kingdom for years, which is so weird.
It makes me think of when he comes back after that 100 years, and some of the Zora still remember him, the adult Zora remember him, and they're like, hey, we were best friends, and then you disappeared for 100 years. What's up? How are you? And they're just like happy to have him back. This is the same thing of like, there are people that remember him and are so happy to share their updates with him, but it's like, he's not going out of his way to see them. They're just like so happy that he's around. So he just like rarely gets around. He has all of Hyrule to see only when Zelda wants to be there. I think not necessarily that he was hiding in Hyrule Castle the whole time, but just like he was only where Zelda was. And based on what we learn throughout Tears of the Kingdom, it seems like even that he wasn't on all of those missions.
Well, and also I've had the experience where a lot of people do recognize me. Like a lot of people are like, Link, where you been? What's up, dude? Because I think that there has been some time between like when the events happen where Zelda gets sent into the past and Link gets all messed up and then goes up into the sky to heal. Like, I think that there was time where Link was absent and everybody was like, where's Link and Zelda? And now it feels like every person I've met has been like, Link, I'm so glad you're okay. Where's Zelda now? And yeah, it's just, it's fun. And also keep in mind, with Breath of the Wild, Link was waking up after whatever it is, like 100 years or 1,000 years or whatever.
100, yeah.
Yeah, that like he was not super established in that world to begin with.
No, but you would think after saving the world once that people would maybe remember you a bit more.
Some of them, but listen, Hyrule's big.
True. I mean, like, all right. I was about to say that it's not like they went around and made a bunch of posters and statues saying Link saved the kingdom, but one person made a statue. Have you been to Zora's Domain?
Yeah, I have. I forgot about that. Yeah, that is...
It's a really good statue.
This is like all Joe has been talking about.
That's not true. But I did make her look at it when it happened.
I'm going to do, one spoiler on that. But yeah, like the whole picture, the whole statue, I was like, oh, they really lent into that like Sidonis and Link relationship thing that's going on.
Sidon. Sidonis is a Mass Effect character, I think.
There you go. That's where my head is all the time. But slight spoilers if no one's encountered that. The thing is, you get like, oh, look, here's the really like gay statue together where like one's riding the other or something. And then you immediately like, who showed you this? Well, it's your boyfriend's fiance. And it's like, oh, they just made him straight. Oh, fuck. It's fine. It's a political marriage.
They set that up in such a fun way, though, because that statue is put exactly where Mipha's statue was, and it's covered in sludge. So you go into the area, and you don't know that it's not just Mipha's statue still. Yeah. And they're like, oh, we really have to get this statue cleaned off. All these things have gone wrong. But most importantly, we have to clean that statue. And then you get the reveal after you've cleaned the statue of like, oh, that's a statue of me on Sidon's back.
Yeah, it's mad. This was a massive tangent of my original thing of like tutorializing. But so mentioning the Yiga underground, they also have like little bases that you can stumble upon. And those bases use, that is not coming up on screen, but thank you anyway.
I just have what it says, but you're fine.
Go on.
All right. So now that I've interrupted you, this is Sidon's girlfriend or fiance saying, that's right, beloved Prince Sidon of the Zora and his very best friend, Sir Link, the heroic Hylian swordsman.
They're friends.
Very best friends.
They were roommates.
Yeah, they discover the Zora statue after like 1,000 years, and it's like they were roommates. But yes, the Yiga have like small hideouts underground. They're patrolled by Yiga in like Zonai device constructed things. They're the only ones so far that I've encountered that use actual Zonai devices as well, which I find interesting. They set up these camps with defenses. So there are some which have like turrets with beam emitters, and then they have like enemy facing flame breath things. So you have to face these obstacles. Once you overcome them, you then unlock the schema stones, which are like the plans to make these things in the auto builder. So you're being tutorialized how these things will affect you to then learn what the scheme is to make them. And then you can use them against your enemies. So it's literally making you face things which you then know how to utilize right afterwards. So it gives you the potential to set traps when you know, like, there's Mokoblin hordes or whatever about, and if you feel outnumbered at any point, you just set some zonite devices down that you have schemes for, and boom, I now have a massive advantage that I didn't before. It's just such a great system of encountering the thing and then knowing that you can then do it again. The auto builder is actually a massive change to the play that I'm amazed. Like, one of my critiques, I'm going to stop in a minute, I realize I'm going on, but one of the critiques that I have is sort of what Joe had. You are not actually very well guided in how to gain stuff. Like, you can miss the paraglider for a long time. The auto build, I had to be told by a colleague, they were like, go down, follow those statues after you do the, like, camera quest, because you're going to need it. You're going to love it. And I was like, what is this? And I was like, ah, okay, this makes total sense now. This is why they wanted it. And I actually started to build more zonite, like, machinery stuff after getting that auto builder, because I didn't have to, like, one by one doing crap. I could just be like, I grab all of this, and then I grab a base, and then maybe attach a few more things to, like, customize it. And then I'm figuring things out, and it's just, the tutorializing is great.
Yeah, I was building things a lot after a while in the depths, just one at a time, so slowly. And, like, at that point, I had seen Cassie get the auto builder, and I was like, I just haven't gotten around back to it. But I do wish I had gotten it earlier. It would have saved me so much time. I spent so long, like, messing around with things and making mistakes and dying, and my entire device is gone. But now it's just like, well, I have so much zonai, whatever, or
zonite
that it's not really a problem if I just have to spawn new stuff in. Even if I don't open the capsules for everything, I can just spawn it in and cost me some zonite. Which, by the way, wouldn't that be like if we found a rock and just called it humanite?
Sure. I think you're thinking a little bit too much about that.
But zonai are the people, right?
Maybe the zonai were named after the rock.
Must be.
They're the machine.
No, the zonai are the people, like King Rauru.
Rauru is a zonai.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So talking about the auto builder. So I got the auto builder, I think, very early on compared to you two. Mm. I was just running around in the depths and happened to stumble across it, which was very lucky, I would say. I really haven't used it much at all, so I guess I will try it. But I kind of enjoy building things, and I enjoy, like, there's a simplicity and efficiency that I think I take to building things that... One of the cute little things in the world that you can encounter is this guy who is holding up signs, and he needs to, like, nail these signs down and build a permanent structure for them. But you need to construct something that will hold the sign up while he builds that. And Joe watched me build one with, like, I don't know, like a piece of wood and like one post, and it did it. And he was like, wow, I really over engineered these things that, like, you can create these insane things. But I kind of enjoy being like, how can I build this with as few things as possible? Like, how can I make this as efficient as possible?
And then 20 minutes later, she walked over with one single post, put it underneath, and that was all it took. I mean, like, each one of them like is a separate challenge, but that one truly just was one post upright, nothing supporting it at all.
I have had to make some stupid shit for some of these, but some of them is just, yeah. So, like, I feel like the auto builder might take some of that away, but also I feel those signs are unique enough that, like, you can't just make one thing with the auto builder and have it work for all of those signs. But yeah, I've really enjoyed all of that. I don't know how you remedy these problems, though, of, like, you can go for so long without the paraglider, you can go for so long without the auto builder, because I do think that the game signposts you enough to toward those things.
They really try and get you to the things that will help you.
Yeah.
They really do have people out there saying, like, hey, go check this out. Like, because even when you don't have the mission saying, go get the auto builder, you have the mission saying, like, hey, like, what's up with Robbie in the depths that you've been ignoring? Like, it's been in your main quest. Like, unless you never went to Lookout Landing and talk to people, that's the only real reason that you could not know about all these missions. But knowing where those missions go to is a whole different thing. Like, I walked away from go back and talk to Pura and didn't realize that was the only step between me and a paraglider.
And he watched me do that and was like, oh, I guess I should probably go back and get the paraglider.
This is the thing. Like, I know you said there's not really a remedy, but at the same time, the opening of the game literally restricts you to the sky, the Great Sky Plateau, mm-hmm. just like Breath of the Wild did. It's a very nice, like, callback to that. And I felt like that was such a very tight and well, like, developed area, because mm-hmm. I know you might have different theories by that face, but it introduced you to so many mechanics of what you would use later, because it was like, if you don't get past this, you can't really get past this. Or if you're going to, you're going to cheese it real bad. But like, you know, how to stick stuff together and how physics works to bring you down on certain platforms, things like that. It made you go through these things before you could access the rest of the game. So it did artificially stop you from progressing. And it didn't give you anything out of that. Like, the Great Plateau in Breath of the Wild gave you the paraglider. You can't leave the Great Plateau until you get the paraglider. So that is a staple part of your experience. So there are things that they wanted you to finish in Breath of the Wild, and one was to get the paraglider to make the rest of the game playable. Mm-hmm. And it's weird to think that that wasn't an integral part of Tears of the Kingdom, because you can't actually finish the game unless you have the glider. I've spoiled myself because I was like, oh, what's the speed running in this game? And you need the paraglider from everything I've seen. So it's not something that you can miss and progress as a casual player for sure. So why that isn't a required thing? Like, why didn't they put you under a dome to begin with when you first land down? Like, Ganon put something down or whatever. And then once you complete that, boom, you get the paraglider. You know that there's another power down there in the depths. It's very vague about what the Zonai power is down there. That because you've already got the camera and then you get the auto builder, the priorities that you're sending to the player is, oh, these are like little bonuses that you get. They're not actually going to affect how you play. It should have been the other way around. You should have got the auto builder and then the camera, because that's more integral to the play experience, I find, anyway.
Maybe to your play experience, but I love taking photos of every little plant that is over the place.
I think that's the fun part of, like, they lured you into the depths with the promise of a camera. Like, they knew that the camera was enough for some players, where it was like, you need to get this camera. This is the only... To progress with Robbie, you have to go into the depths in order to get the camera from him. And then that points you directly to the first statue, which organically tells you go to the, like, follow those statues. And yes, you have to go back up to the surface and get that mission from Josha or Josha. And she explains what those statues do. But even if you decided to stay down there afterwards, you could theoretically follow those statues around. Like, I made it to the Gerudo Mine following statues without knowing I was supposed to, because I never went back and got the camera. But I was like, oh, these are just like facing the next one. And I went and did that, and I got to the Gerudo Mine. Nothing is there yet, because, I mean, like, some stuff is there, but like, not the main thing was there already, because I hadn't done the earlier stuff. But you can kind of intuit a lot of that stuff, even if you don't go back up to get your handheld.
Whilst I do agree, the problem is if they give you... I know some people say, like, oh, it's very hand-holdy when games give you quests, but those quests are generally to point you, as a player who doesn't know how this world is supposed to work or how this game has been set up, to, like, figure things out. And I think just the way that they prioritize some of the main quests... Like, main quests, in my mind, from every other RPG, is... I need to finish these to finish the game. So it doesn't matter the order I do these in. So if you're like, oh, I'll investigate all four like areas of the map because that's one quest that Pure has given me, I could be doing every single region and not have the auto build as part of that, because that's a separate main quest and I can come back to that another time. And let's be honest, there's no like real emergency to that quest either. It's like, oh, if you follow these things, there's like some strange, like powerful thing that's down there. It's like, okay, cool. But the Rito are dying out there. In right. terms of emergencies, me finding a little bit of a power, which honestly at the time I thought was going to be like an armor that was going to be useful early game. I didn't really care necessarily. I wanted to go to the Rito village. I don't think that they gave that stuff enough weight for what it is. Like, to move on a little bit, have either of you finished the Dragon Tears quest at all?
I have not.
I have done most of it, but I have not done the last two. Or I don't know what order, but I'm still missing two of them.
Cool. So, not to spoil any of the story elements that happen in there or after, but I did not realize how integral that would be to the overall narrative aspect of the game, and also the gameplay aspect of it. It's such a key, like, beat that the idea that you could defeat the final boss and never experience it boggles my mind, because it is such a narrative pin to the experience. But it doesn't give you that sense of urgency. It's like, oh, these things have been popping around. I wonder what this could mean. It's supposed to be centered like a mystery, but it doesn't really turn out like that necessarily. This is what I imagine is the story outside of like the problems.
Yeah, this is like the memories from the previous game in a lot of ways. It was interesting. I was constantly told by Impa, like every time you interact with her, because she's the one that's researching these geoglyphs, along with like random passerbys are like, oh, cool, geoglyphs. Let's check this out. But Impa, every time you see her, is like, go to the Forgotten Temple. Go to the Forgotten Temple. Go to the Forgotten Temple. And I was like, yeah, I'll get to it. I'll figure that out eventually. But in my head, I was like, okay, if I go there, I'm definitely just going to get the Hylian tunic, because that's what you get from Impa after you get a single memory in Breath of the Wild. I was like, I'm just going to get the Champion's Tunic. So I put that off and put that off and finally get there. And, oh, it's like, oh, here's this thing that would just make doing this so much more convenient. Like, if you just listened to Impa the first time, you would have had this thing to just find the geoglyphs a lot easier. Just make your life a little bit easier.
I think that the game is relying on, for the Tears quest, is relying on you having interest in Impa, first of all, because when they present it to you, it's like, Impa wants to talk to you, go see Impa, and relying on you being interested in, like, what happened to Zelda? Because they give you, like, a little taste early on where they show Link, like, sends the Master Sword into the past, and so, like, I think that the Tears quest, they're hoping that you're kind of intrinsically motivated to do that through those little glimpses. It reminds me, Ross, of our conversation about Dragon Age, where I was like, I don't know why I went to Redcliffe first. Why didn't I want to go learn about the dwarves and the elves? And you were like, no, because Alistair says to you, like, the Arl of Redcliffe was like a father to me. Like, we should really go talk to the Arl of Redcliffe. And so, like, that little bit of signposting maybe would have been helpful. But I feel like they're doing that to an extent already.
I do agree. I think my problem is that a lot of game design will usually try to put rewards in front of you to incentivize you to continue on, because you'll feel like you're gaining something from doing a task.
And progression.
Yeah, progression. So the Tears quest give you cutscenes, which I'm, as a narrative nerd, love to just experience the story. Pretty much one of my main objectives was, before I really do anything after doing, I believe, the Rito, I wanted to get every tower, and whilst I'm doing that, I want to do the Dragon's Tears quest stuff in order that they're supposed to be played, because I wanted to experience it in the order that it's presented. So I was darting back and forth between different regions to get everything in a certain order, which also helped me explore the world in an interesting way. But all I was getting for all of this effort was more of the map revealed and a short cutscene, like a minute or minute and a half, which, realistically, for the majority of players, is probably not going to be enough. So if they gave you some special currency or even some rupees, just something when you...
I could use the rupees.
Yeah, the rupees especially. If it gave me 10 arrows, I would have done them immediately. But just anything to incentivize why you're doing it that's not just narrative focused would have, I imagine, compelled a lot more people to probably pursue them.
Yeah.
The thing is, and I'm not going to spoil it, but the last thing that you do in this whole quest line, you get a major piece of equipment that you're like, why was this never really, like, the importance of it was not really brought up. And there's a whole big thing about it. And I'm like, it just didn't align with everything that I was experiencing. Because the whole cutscene thing is pretty passive. And then the final bit of it is very active and very like narrative relevant. So it just didn't scale properly. And I feel like a few of those main quests don't scale properly with your expectations.
I think I can make a guess at that major piece of equipment that you're referring to with the the tears stuff. But like, you can go through all of Breath of the Wild without getting that major piece of equipment as well.
True.
I think you're thinking of two different things. Because I've gotten the other thing.
Mm, okay, we're talking in riddles right now.
So, by the way, getting that, I got through the Lost Woods, or not actually through, but I got into Korok Forest. I freed the Deku Tree. He's like, I can show you where the Master Sword is, but it's moving. And so I'm like, okay, I'll deal with that later. I'll fucking deal with that later. Whatever.
That's madness in my mind. Here's the Master Sword that broke in the beginning and is now just in the world. And
So like, okay, I'm going to try and figure this out. I'm going to go back. I'm going to talk to the Deku Trees again, like try and actually to solve this. So I went back a while later and solved this to try and solve this. I was like, okay, it's moving. And now it's in a totally different spot, which makes sense. He just said it was moving. Because when he said it's up in the sky, it was like right above the Lost Woods. So I was like, okay, I don't have a way up there right now. Because I had tried to do that earlier and I didn't have a great way there. I didn't have the tower that was nearby.
Right. Yet. Okay. Yeah. That would screw you.
When I finally got onto this fucking dragon to get the Master Sword, which I'm like, okay, I'm going to the pin on my map. I'm teleporting to a thing nearby. What on earth is nearby? I'm like, I'm about to fly over to this ominous cloud is in that general direction. I'm going to fly into the ominous cloud. No, the cloud moves out of the way. The cloud is no longer the point. It's a fucking dragon in the sky, which I had seen before. I was like, oh, cool, a new dragon. And then I'm on its face and I'm texting my little sister's boyfriend. We've both been obsessively texting each other. I'm texting him and I'm like, hey, we both like he had gotten the Master Sword first. So I finally get it. And I'm like, hey, that dragon fucking looks like Zelda, doesn't it? That dragon looks like Zelda. And at this point, neither of us had finished the memories. So like then to go backwards and get those memories and be like, oh shit, that dragon is Zelda. That was very satisfying.
I know you're not that bothered, Cass, just looking at your face, but the whole main plot is where's the fuck Zelda? Like, where's she at? And this whole fucking main quest, which was just like, oh, well, this is what she used to do. It's fine. And then at the end of it, you not only find the fucking Master Sword, but you find she's up in the fucking sky and has been roaming around this fucking, you know, world for however many thousands of years or whatever, just in a dragon body now with the Master Sword in a damn head. I was just...
And a stone stuck in her throat, apparently, or something.
This is a lot of information. I can't tell, Ross, if you like this or not, though.
I like it, but this is what I'm saying about my problem with some of the main quests, like waiting about how much you should care and how much you shouldn't. Because the idea that, like I say, you're not compelled by rewards, apart from cutscenes, to finish off the Dragon's Tear stuff, that all you're doing is just getting cutscenes. Now, for most players, that just looks like a narrative reward. You'll get a payoff eventually, but you don't think you're going to get the Master Sword and Zelda's location. It's just so weighted by the end about how much interest I had. So, like, I imagine natural players, like, if they're going to pursue this, like, they may not pursue this at all. They may be like, well, I never actually found Zelda until, I don't know, the end game. I don't quite know the ending. But there's just this whole section of game. Like, the Master Sword being in Farron Woods was definitely a big thing in Breath of the Wild. But this is two big mysteries in one, because the Master Sword wasn't an integral part of this story in Breath of the Wild, when it's literally in the fucking opening of the game where it breaks cuts Ganon and it's like, oh, this might be the only thing that can kill this guy. Like, its importance is massive. And it's just this fucking narrative, cutscene-driven geoglyph quest for 12 of them. It's not even fucking short. It just, I like it, but it does not compel you enough and give its importance.
See, but I'm like, I'm kind of okay with that. And that's why I said, like, I feel like I'm complete playing this game for the next year. And like, I kind of enjoy that. Like, I kind of enjoy that this game right now is for me. Like, I'm going to check in and like dick around a little bit, do a couple of shrines, like do a side quest or two. And like every week or so, like do a memory, or every couple days do a memory. Every couple days go to like one of these, like to the Rito village. And like, I'm kind of enjoying that like leisurely pace to it, that I don't feel that pressure to like, I have to go here, I have to do, I have to, like, it's just kind of nice to like, we talked about this with Breath of the Wild. The one thing that we both said that we really, it's just that like, it's a nice game to just hang out in and take that like casual pace with. Now, I understand like wanting to see it all and like being really, really excited. But me being somebody who was not like hot on Breath of the Wild, like I don't have that like natural like hype and need to see everything and like need to like, I want to see it all before it gets spoiled for me. I'm just kind of enjoying like taking it at a slow pace and not feeling that pressure to do all these things. I totally agree, though. They should not let you leave Lookout Landing without a paraglider. Like, it'd be simple to just put a little guard on the wall, and like if you drop outside the wall, I'd be like, hey, wait, no, you gotta go talk to Pyrrha. Like, come on back.
But also, if you're gonna make it an open world,
I know,
and actually have it be an open world, you have to let people make mistakes.
You have to let dumbasses do shrines without a paraglider.
Yeah, I did too many shrines without paragliders.
This is what I mean, though. If you're going to design an experience for players and for the atypical player, the most basic type of how you're guiding players, you need to do it in a way which...
The normies.
Yeah, if you have to use a derogatory term. But if you have to go, what's the largest, like, my design, how is it going to affect the largest amount of players in the right way, rather than just being completely like, because this is sold 10 million copies or whatever, and it's
in like
whatever,
a day,
something.
In like 2 hours,
just a massive launch. Out of those 10 million players, how many are not going to encounter the auto build? How many people are going to miss like certain content out that they then put the game down because they're like, oh, this is too much, or this is too hard, and I don't want to try and like do this because they missed one piece of equipment or one like aspect of the game. But it's just, that's what makes this more frustrating for me, is they were so close for it to be a perfect introduction type thing that they just failed slightly. And I know that not everyone's going to have this opinion, and even designers will be like, as you say as well, it's an open world. There's only so much handholding and guidance that you can give. But when it's such a basic part of gameplay that affects everything else, if you don't give your players access to that, you aren't asking them to try and figure out another way of doing it. You're hampering them for no good reason.
Sure. Yeah, like I think we do need to think about that there are literal children playing this game.
That's the other thing.
And like, I think of a very dear friend and neighbor of mine who has a child who's 11 years old, and I mentioned to her once, like, yeah, we're excited for the new Zelda game to come out, and she told me about how her daughter, who is 11, likes to play Breath of the Wild, but the monsters scare her, so she like sits with her mom and plays the game. Like, that is the audience that I'm like, give that kid the paraglider. Like, she really needs that paraglider.
And then also, as a second grade teacher, I had a student a couple years ago who was so excited, telling me about Breath of the Wild, telling me about what he was doing. He was like, I finally got into Gerudo Village so that I could buy electric, like, shock arrows, so that I don't have to deal with the Lynel. Because if you remember, the Zora quest required you to get 20 shock arrows to do it. And to do that, they point you towards this big, scary Lynel that you can like either fight or sneak around to collect the shock arrows. He's like, but instead you can go to the Gerudo village and just buy them so you don't have to deal with the Lynel.
Yeah. Like it's things, but then, you know, I don't know.
But also
he
figured it out. He got there.
I think the paraglider though is so integral, and it sounds like I have not found the auto builder to be that integral, but I'm maybe just not using it the way I should. I get that. I think that those two things, like, it's tricky.
I think the auto builder is soon enough on the main quests, but separated enough where I do think they wanted you to mess around with those with just the Ultra Hand, so that when you got that auto builder, it was like, oh, yeah, cool.
Well, but this is still so convenient. You still have to mess around with Ultra Hand because, yes, like, you don't have the schematics right away. You have, yes, to like make your own.
But also, like, having the auto builder be later on is like, okay, this is like a real reward. This is a, mm-hmm, a thing that I have earned rather than just I was handed to in, sure, the beginning.
Yeah.
Because the auto builder might have made the building more trivial.
Sure. I think that it is a big improvement over Breath of the Wild in the tutorializing and in the not hand-holding, but you get what I mean by that. I think that there's still things that are not perfect, but I think on the whole, it does it a lot better and more fluidly,
yeah,
than Breath of the Wild.
You could say it's ultra hand-holding.
Okay. All right, we need to stop now. One thing I do have to ask about, Ross, because we touched on this when we talked about our early impressions, that one of your big conflicts with Breath of the Wild was the durability system.
Mm.
And we had talked lightly about how the fusion system can be kind of a remedy to that for you. And,
massively,
and Joe,
yes,
and I were talking about this earlier today, that we're like, what you can do is you can fuse just about anything to the weapon that you are holding. Like, you can fuse toenails from a Hinox to the weapon that you're holding. You can fuse another weapon to your weapon, and like these things change the properties of the weapon and make it stronger or work differently. Joe and I were talking about this earlier today, that like we don't feel like it is removing the weapon degradation system. It's just changing it.
Yes.
You know, so I'm curious about how you've come out of that.
Most of my early thoughts that I mentioned last time pretty much stand here, which is, so one of the biggest problems was weapon degradation. Now, some of my potential ways to get around that I thought of in my spare time talking with other people at my work. Look, I'm down
trying to go to sleep, you're thinking about, how do I get around weapon degradation in Breath of the Wild?
Look, one thing of like my creative director at my studio does is pretty much when we're talking about games, he goes, how would you have improved it, or what would you have changed? And I'm like, he's doing this because he wants me to actually think about the design of something and go like push myself to be in the shoes of another designer and what would I do?
No, I totally get that, because whenever I'm like watching anything, I like think of it of like, how are they teaching me this? Like, where's that gradual release model? And also just when I'm watching like TV, I have to like turn off English teacher brain and be like, no, we don't need to be thinking about symbolism right now. Like, yeah. Anyway, go on.
Some of the solutions I had for Breath of the Wild ideas was just have an elixir which allows you to increase the durability, like maybe the next 20 swings or whatever, and then it breaks. Maybe an actual proper repair system where you pick up a branch, and if you have a wooden mallet or whatever, you can use the branch to repair the mallet so that you have this ability to keep these weapons longer if you like them. Not to the point of removing the system completely, because that would fundamentally change the game, but increasing that durability potential. So I wanted that, and the fuse system basically delivered that in a system that was way beyond my thinking, because it fixed so many other issues I had. So the fact that you can fuse anything with anything, which increases its attack power and its durability. The durability is still like vague as hell about what it actually, yes, like, how many swings have I got left? So I'm still
hoarding. I wish there was like a meter, you know, yeah, just, of like, this is at 50% durability. Yeah,
just some more indication. It doesn't have to be exact numbers of swings even. It can just be like a random percentage, like 75, mm-hmm, and then 50 and then 25. Mm-hmm. So I get a general idea. That is one problem I still have. But the idea that I can just see, oh, my endurability will increase. Great. I can now like just do this, and I know if I like this weapon, I'll do it. Or if I pick up a branch and I'm like, well, I don't really need another stick for something, I can now fuse a sword onto it to make it a slashing weapon. It gives you that option now where you aren't hampered down by whatever you just stumble across and have its properties. You now have more customization about what your weapons are. And it delves deeper than that. So I mentioned how one of the problems I have with the degradation system in Breath of the Wild is I am not encouraged to fight enemies that I don't need to, because there's a load of like macoblin camps and stuff that you can stumble onto, and they have chests there, and it's like you're rewarded for clearing out the camp and getting what's in the chest. The problem is you don't know what's in the chest. You don't know if it's worth your time and effort that I can go through three weapons potentially just to open a chest and go, oh, it's 20 arrows. Well, I did use 18 arrows and I wasted two swords on this encounter. So this was totally worth it. That I just sort of lost a lot of enthusiasm for doing things. I felt so hoardy than I needed to be. So instead of this hoarding mechanic now, I feel like I can pick up anything, put something onto it, and feel that I'm going to keep it for a while. I might keep it for certain encounters. There's one like silver Lizardos spear thing that I have that does over 50 damage, and I'm like, this is the boss weapon or a line of weapon. I'm going to use this whenever I encounter a big health bar. And then I rank my own weapons about how useful they are. And I feel encouraged to, yeah, experiment a bit more. But even if I have a decent weapon, I want to still, like, infuse something on it because of that attack power boost. So this is the other thing. It's encouraging you to fuse because every time you fuse, you will get more benefits than anything. The only real downside is if you're fusing two weapons together, which the game never really encourages you to do. It tells you to use monster parts.
Oh, I do that all the time.
Okay, fine. It encourages you to use monster parts and stuff because you are killing monsters. You're gaining actual tangible things from them that are making elixirs, which I thought were sort of subpar as a route in Breath of the Wild. Or you can increase your attack potential. So you have both offensive and defensive options now as part of like monster hunting. And like I say, if you have a long stick, you now have a spear, but that spear can then have properties of like a blunt weapon, which will destroy rocks or certain rock type enemies. Or you can put a blade on the end of it to make it a slashing type thing, which will destroy certain wood type enemies and stuff. There's just the small inclusion of a fuse system has totally changed how combat can work in a way. And not only combat, but preparation. That is now an aspect I'm thinking of when I'm picking up a weapon. I'm not thinking, I now have a big claymore. I'm thinking, do I make a really big club from it because I need to get through this like tunnel where I know there's going to be a load of these talus things? Or do I keep it as a sword, but make it a bigger blade that's more powerful, but then it's maybe, you know, I don't know, less useful? Or if I don't like that aspect, I then have to destroy the thing I've attached to it. There's loads more questions, and they're not bad questions. They're questions to benefit you that you need to answer.
I love sticking weapons on weapons for a couple different reasons. I like the powers that you can get from some of the weapons.
That's true.
Which is a huge change from the previous ones of, okay, there's like some of these are improved flurry rushes, or like faster charge, or one of my favorites because I'm a monster is the knight's one has desperate strength. If you are down to one heart, it doubles the attack power. So I will intentionally leave myself with just one heart and have the double strength weapon. But also if I get a relatively strong claymore and I want to use it as a sword, I can just attach that claymore to a sword I have or to just a stick. And now I'm getting the strength of that claymore and the reach of that claymore, and I'm using it like a sword. I love sticking spears onto spears and have ridiculous reaches.
Yes.
Or spears onto literally anything and have ridiculous reaching. It's so combining weapons to weapons is very fun as well. It's also for me, I hate leaving stuff behind. I do leave stuff behind when I need to, but like, okay, I just killed these enemies and they dropped like two really good, two like pretty good weapons, because nothing's really good anymore. Two pretty good weapons. So I'm just going to fuse them to the shit I have. I'll destroy the rock or whatever I had fused to this one and fuse on this weapon instead. I also love never having to waste an inventory spot on a Korok leaf anymore. Anything can be a fan if I needed to.
Yep.
Anything can break a bolt. Anything can break a rock if I need to. And anything can cut down a tree if I need to.
Yeah. The other thing is the combat in both games is relatively simplistic. It is basically just one attack button which combos or a charge attack, and there's like jump attacks and stuff, but really the combat is incredibly basic. But yeah. the depth of yes. what the system gives you is very large because of these different weapon types, property types. Yeah, things like having extra reach from fusing a spear on spear. If there is a depth that is there that I would say was maybe only half there in Breath of the Wild, and it made combat not that interesting realistically, because I know one of the reasons the whole degradation system was there was, oh, well, we want you to experiment with the types of weapon that you have, so you're not just stuck with swords all the time or like claymores all the time or spears. But realistically, you only had those three as your main weapon type. You had the boomerangs if you fought the Lizardos things. And I think that was really it for weapon variety. There just wasn't much in Breath of the Wild. So even though they were encouraging you to try new things, realistically, you just fell back on your basics anyway. Whilst here, I feel like there is a greater depth to what you want to pick and choose. And you can customize how you play. Like, I would never have thought of actually fusing two weapons with bonus property types to them, and they would both have that effect. That changes my ideas immensely, because there are, like, Zora weapons, which, if you are wet, you double your attack power.
Yes.
So I'm now thinking, like, oh, so if I put a really powerful thing on the end of, like, another powerful weapon on the end of this, and I'm, you know, in the water or whatever, I can double my attack power. Now, if I have the one heart and the desperate strength thing, I'm quadrupling my attack power. Oh, my God, what can I do?
I'll stop you there. I'll put some water on you right now and say it keeps the base weapon's power.
Okay, that's still fine.
It gets rid of the thing that you're attaching to. I've also noticed that if you attach it to a weapon that has like an attack up bonus, that bonus is also gone if that's the one that you're fusing it to. The base one keeps all its stuff. The one you're attaching it to loses it. However, if you have gotten any gloom weapons, the ones that like hurt you, if you put that on top of another weapon, that gets rid of that. So now I just the power of that really strong weapon, but I don't have to deal with the consequences.
Nice. I just think all of that has pretty much solved my big gripes, because there is such an abundance of everything that I don't feel like, even if I pick up a really powerful sword or whatever, even if I didn't want to waste some of my really high level monster parts on it, I could still make it more powerful, more durable, just by attaching a basic bokoblin type thing. I mean, it's not a massive difference at the damage levels it gives, but that's still something which will give me a benefit. And that's the sort of system I like about it. And they even expanded it to the point of what I found really interesting was the whole ore attachments. So you can make a wizard's wand out of anything. So you now have really easy access to like four elements. So if you know that you're fighting a fire type enemy, you attach a sapphire to the end of a sword if you really need to, and it will deal ice damage. I now have a really easy way to deal with fire enemies. And it's just that sort of the Rochambeau, the Pokemon type advantage thing that I now have instant access to, when before I would have to find like a Wizardos's enemy, kill that, take its wand, and then it would be boom, 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 I'm done with it. Well, now I just have to keep going or find another one.
Yeah, I wish I had known that before doing the Zora area, because like dealing with the sludge there without any like water thing of like, I was just spawning in fire hydrants constantly. I'm like, this seems like a waste of time and resources. And like, I'm attaching them to the shield. This could be so convenient. And the shield breaks after like half the fight. I'm like, okay, perfect. If I knew that you could utilize that water power, especially because in Breath of the Wild, you only have the three. You have the fire, the ice, and the electricity. Adding that water power changes a lot more than you would think, despite the fact that water doesn't seem like it should be very powerful in terms of like an actual battle.
Yeah. And I can't remember if they did this with the first game, but this is the other thing as well. Maybe I'm wrong, but they've expanded it. So it's not just monster parts either or gems. the fruit and vegetables that you can just scrounge up now have properties to them. So you can have fire arrows from fire fruit, or like ice attacks from certain things, and like sparkle fruit or whatever. And all of these things, which you can just attach to a bow or whatever, or throw it. You can, I don't remember if this is in Breath of the Wild, but you can just throw things out of your inventory now. So that's just a big change, that you can throw instant fires or instant bombs or instant water bombs. And it's like, they have an effect that you didn't need to scrounge for like before. So you have this expanded arsenal.
Can either of you imagine going back to Breath of the Wild?
Hell no. Jeremiah.
Yeah. I'll pick it up and play it eventually, but maybe when I'm done with this.
It just feels like a Pandora's box situation of like, now that I see what's possible, like, how do I go back?
I miss the bombs so much.
I get that. I'm like running low on bomb flowers.
Although I know Cassie's been having trouble getting arrows. But I have so many arrows.
Yeah. Joe had like 750 when I was watching him play before. I was like, what the hell are you doing?
I'm destroying every pot. I'm destroying every crate. I am going out of my way to like just harvest arrows.
Which,
what I like about being able to attach stuff to the arrows is that now it's not split up into the bomb arrows, fire arrows, ice arrows of like, oh, I only have two ice arrows. Now it's like, I have any arrow I want as long as I can get my hands on the material.
I will plug for anybody here who we talked with Dragon Age about, like, just cheat to make it easier. There are amiibo that you can scan in Breath of the Wild and in Tears of the Kingdom to get various items, including weapons, including arrows, including special outfits.
Pay to win.
Except, listen, amiibo are fucking expensive and rare. You can go online to various reputable websites and purchase, because amiibos use a technology called NFC, which is like a totally, like, there's a lot of NFC stuff. One can go onto a website such as Etsy or eBay and purchase for $8 to $15 a pack of NFC cards of every Zelda amiibo.
So many Zelda amiibo that we hit a thing in Breath of the Wild would accept all of them. Mm-hmm. And in Tears of the Kingdom, we have like seven. Yeah, that
there's got to be like 20 total. There's a lot of them.
But like seven of them, it says like, hey, you can't use this again today. Meanwhile, we scanned a different one.
So you scan these amiibo and it just drops treasure chests and like items for you. And like this has been, so my pattern of playing this game is like, fire it up, scan all of my amiibo, because you can only do it once per day. And then I just get enough stuff to carry me throughout my journey. And that has really been my kind of like, I don't want to deal with all this bullshit, so I'm just going to cheat. So I very highly recommend these amiibo cards to you all. And then you don't have to have all these fucking amiibo all over the place. You can just have a little thing of amiibo cards. So very, very highly recommend.
I'm also not going to lie, because I thought I'd research a little. Just alone, the paraglider skins that you can get for these are great.
So cool.
They are so great. Good.
And that's actually how we found out that there is a paraglider, because Joe started this game before me and he's like, I still haven't gotten a paraglider. And I was like, okay, I got my amiibo power. I'm going to scan my amiibo. And I'm like, I'm getting paraglider skins. So there must be a paraglider in this game. Yeah, you can get some sick paraglider skins and you can get some sick outfits. So like, my favorite outfit to run around in is the Twilight Princess outfit. I think that it looks nice. It fits well colors wise, aesthetics wise in the Breath of the Wild world. So like, I like to run around in my Twilight Princess outfit. Yeah, I very, very much enjoy those amiibo.
Although I will say, of all the paraglider skins, I have a Hudson Construction paraglider fabric that I'm currently using, and it's very good.
I've been rocking the Cuckoo paraglider skin.
I've only got the Horse God because I've barely got any fabric.
Take some pictures.
How are you feeling about pony points?
Oh,
this is a brutal side. Fine. It gives a sort of encouragement to engage with the stables a lot more, which I never really did much. Like, I registered a horse or two, and then don't think I might have slept in the bed once or twice, but I never felt compelled to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And the fact that you get them for just finding them and then yeah, sleeping in a bed or finding.
You get pony points for sleeping in a bed?
Yep.
At the stable,
yes.
I have not slept at all.
Exactly. This is what I mean.
So I was thinking, oh, I've got these sleepover tickets. That'll be a perfect way to accrue pony points. Mm. But they explicitly don't give you points for the sleepover tickets.
But they're 20 rupees. It's like, okay.
I'm and if poor. You pick
hey, the, I have no rupees.
I've got like a consistent 2,000 rupees at the moment.
What? What are you selling?
I spent a lot of my money on a house.
Oh, you can buy a house in this one again. Is that in Tarrytown by chance?
If you couldn't guess, yeah.
I mean, I get, yeah.
He did guess. He literally guessed on air.
I've been exploring a lot more and like generic things have just been popping up. I mean, meat sells for like 20
rupees.
It
sells for less. It sells for less than it did in the previous one. So
still, it's like one of the easiest things to get to. If you just like especially headshot a moose, you get 5 gourmet.
Or just scan your amiibo and meat falls from the sky if you have the Wolf Link amiibo.
I do find it really weird that like they give you cheats that you have to pay for. I guess it's not that weird, but I do. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. Probably not.
It feels
bad.
Great when you're the one benefiting from it for
I probably don't
$8 to $15.
I think the only thing that's stopping me is I know that some of the items that you can discover in the world are things you can cheat in from amiibos, and I'm like, that's a bit.
That was not the case in Breath of the Wild. That was a surprise to me when I was just running around in the depths, and I'm like, I just picked up the fierce deity mask and was like, whoa, what the hell? Yeah, so very highly recommend the amiibo. And then the last thing, actually, I have two quick things on my list left to talk about, as if this wasn't long enough. I have to ask Ross, because I know this has been the case for me and Joe, are you getting blood moons like constantly?
I mean, frequently enough. I feel like them
compared to Breath of the Wild.
I don't remember them too much, but I do remember them cropping up.
Okay.
They feel like they crop up a little bit more in this one for sure.
But I've gotten blood moons constantly.
I keep looking up at the, like, when I'm gliding through the sky or whatever, the speed of the moon like descending in the horizon
it
is like
flies.
Holy shit. I am like, are the days quicker in this one? I think everything is a bit quicker because even the rain doesn't last as long as I remember it lasting. So I feel like they've sped up the time, probably to make you experience several things at once. Maybe there was a lot of waiting in Breath of the Wild that I don't necessarily remember.
There were also like literal zones in Breath of the Wild that were like, it's just raining all the time here.
Yes, there were.
Yeah, and I haven't encountered that yet.
There is sort of like, there's weather phenomena pretty much everywhere, but
yeah.
I do feel like they're trying to, and I think this might be them trying to address the whole slipping on cliff sides thing of, if you're going to encounter rain, the rain probably only lasts for the next 5 to 10 minutes real time, so you can do other stuff in the meanwhile. Or, yeah, it's not as bad as it was, which was like...
And it's less of a barrier now, too, because you have the ascend system.
Yes, that's the
other
thing.
So it's like, it raining is like, I just need to find a slightly different way up. And then the last thing that I'll say is that, like, one of my big complaints that we talked about with Breath of the Wild were the shrines. That, like, I really hated the shrines. And we addressed this a little bit. I will say I've only done one temple so far. I did the Gerudo temple. I liked it a lot better than I liked the Divine Beasts in Breath of the Wild. There were still some things that I found kind of frustrating, but like on the whole, I have not had the very, very negative experience with any of the shrines that I had with Breath of the Wild. So like on the whole, I think it's a super game and a huge improvement on Breath of the Wild.
Do you think that you actually like a Zelda game now?
I don't know. I like, ask me again after I've done 120 shrines and I'll have a wishy-washy answer for you as I did with Breath of the Wild.
Because that's sort of where this has been going, is trying to find the Zelda game that you like.
We can stop the podcast now. Otherwise, it's just going to be me making you play really, really shitty games that I liked when I was 12.
Talk about that soon, I'm sure.
Yes.
So, Ross, have you done those 4 temples that are available?
No, I've only done the Rito Village.
Okay.
I've been pursuing so much other stuff because I haven't felt the need. I want to, but I know that they're going to be a time sink, and I love the exploring and discovering things for myself that I don't want to be railroaded as much.
I started and bounced from them pretty freely. And a lot of them like checkpoint at shrines, which have been nice. Mm. Of like, it's very easy for you to bounce away if you want to. So I haven't ever felt stuck. This is a good game. I'm happy with this.
Yes. No, I'm very
surprised.
You're
here to hear, folks. Tears of the Kingdom. It's a good game.
Can I want to make one more critique, and maybe this will change as I play, but maybe it's something that we pick up again. Oh God, who wants to hear more of us talk about this? But the thing which, this is what you sort of mentioned ages ago now, but I'm sort of surprised how little invested I am with the Sky Islands now. They are basically mini areas, mini game-ish areas that you just quickly delve into. You get a shrine or you get one of the gacha machines and that's it. You don't really have much depth there. Or it's something like a temple which you navigate up, but it's completely separate from the rest of the like area. From the trailers and other things that I was seeing, I was expecting the Sky Islands to be such a bigger presence and a lot more depth to them. And I'm not really feeling that. I'm not feeling compelled to go back. The only thing maybe is I know there are islands a lot higher, but it's not really enough. I don't know what's up there. Like, I don't know if any of you have encountered the spheres in the sky.
Just
yes,
one.
I've gotten to a couple.
But when I experienced them, I was expecting something like, I don't know, another dimension that was in them that you have to like overcome and it would do something. But it's just a big ball in the sky, really, that you just land in. And I'm like, this isn't quite as epic as I was expecting it to be. So it's more like a platforming area than anything, which is so strange.
Yeah,
they are kind of their own like little segmented puzzles. And a lot of them are like, okay, here's this like chunk of islands that are meant to, you just have to get the stone across and get that shrine. But there are like, I have been trying to get to the higher islands, and I've gotten to some of the like pretty high up stuff where like you can't get to with just the towers. And there's some cool stuff up there. All right. Well, good talking to you, Ross.
Good chatting. Thanks for coming.
See ya.
Hi.
Happy to be here in my computer room, and I'm gonna go play more Zelda after I feed this cat.
All right, so now to talk about another excellent, critically acclaimed video game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these two are basically the same.
Bustin' makes me feel good.
Stop. Okay. Ross, the game that I have for you to play, take a break from Zelda. Hit pause on that one.
Okay. It must be a good game, then.
It's a great one. The Sims Bustin' Out for the Game Boy Advance. So to give a little background...
What?
Sims Bustin' Out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Sims Bustin' Out came out in 2003. So this is post Sims 1, but I believe before Sims 2.
Mm-hmm.
It was developed by a little company called Griptonite Games. Have you heard of Griptonite Games, Ross?
Funnily enough, no.
Funnily enough, they developed one of my other favorite games from my childhood, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets on the Game Boy Color. I believe I've said this before on this podcast. Fuck J.K. Rowling. I do not endorse anything about her anymore. But boy, did I love that GBC Chamber of Secrets. So they went on to develop another one of my favorite games, The Sims Bustin' Out. I'm going to check quickly what year The Sims 2 came out so that I don't get angry Sims fans at Sims 2. Yes. Okay. I was right. So these Sims games are in a weird kind of lineage because like, obviously we all know that the core PC Sims experience is like you create your family, you build them a house, you get jobs and you live as those Sims and you have to manage their moods and raise money and do all of this stuff. The Bustin' Out series, and I call it a series in kind of two senses, because there were multiple Bustin' Out games on multiple platforms and they were all kind of different. And because there is actually a sequel to Bustin' Out called The Herbs, which we'll talk about soon. But the Sims Bustin' Out series was kind of an attempt to bring the Sims experience and bring that Sims brand name to other platforms, but make it kind of like a story mode with, ready for it, your favorite word, progression. Uh-huh. So The Sims Bustin' Out, the premise of it is that you are a young adult, you move out to Sim Valley from, I believe, Sim City. You move out to Sim Valley with your uncle who owns a farm. His name is Uncle Hayseed. And you're living on the farm with Uncle Hayseed. You're kind of like a washed up young adult. And your task, your challenge at first, at least, is to bust out and live the like young adult dream to raise enough money to move out of the family home and like strike out on your own. Things unfold in wacky directions from there, but I absolutely love this game, and I am actually really, really curious to hear about it from somebody who is not Sims poisoned like me, and also hear about like how you think that the game did adapting the Sims formula to like a different setting, and also that sense of progression, because this game is just like all about progression, and I think it does it in a really, really fascinating and at times weirdly capitalist way. So like, can you tell me a little bit about your experience with The Sims? Because I feel like that's going to affect what you bring into this game.
I mean, I remember early on having memories of like going around to friends and seeing them play The Sims, because I did not grow up on the PC. I did not own PC games really until I was a teen. So most of my experience was limited to watching other people play games which never were released on consoles. So stuff like Total War, but The Sims was definitely a big one, and that was a really well-known one at the time, a big causing waves or whatever we need to call it. And I never really got to play a Sims until years later, when I had a sort of half-functioning PC that was meant more for schoolwork. So I had The Sims 2, but very, like, ropey, and I didn't know how to play it properly because I wasn't used to a mouse and keyboard. And then years later, when I did actually have a gaming PC, I played The Sims 3. Definitely put a lot of time into that and have played a lot of Sims 4. But that's sort of like the extent. Is everything has been... Oh, I lie. So most of it has been PC in the main series, but there were a number of Sims console games. All of these after the Game Boy Advance ones, but I really did like them. I know people will be like, oh, well, the controls must have been awful because of a controller. And I'm like, I've been using a controller since I was, I don't know, over 20 years. You get used to how control schemes work.
Some of those Sims games did kind of the impossible task, too, of adapting that in, like, a surprisingly fluid manner. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the building is probably the ropiest part, but in terms of the lifestyle, the living as a Sim thing, that was totally doable on consoles. But, yeah, I have loved the games in ways. I mean, even recently, I would say within the last year, it must have been around Christmas, I bought a bunch of the expansions and for Sims 4, and of course, never actually played them properly, because that was just the way of things. You buy the expansions and don't play them.
Okay. Maybe that's your way. Bought many expansions for The Sims.
I remember you mentioning your purchasing history.
Yes, the money that I have spent on The Sims.
Okay. But yeah, I really like The Sims, but I never really played anything pre-Sims 2. So this is...
Okay.
You're recommending me a game which is older than the earliest Sims game I ever made, and it's on the Game Boy Advance?
Yes. And I almost want to tell you to remove The Sims from the equation and just treat this as its kind of own thing, because these console adaptations of The Sims games are like a microcosm of like The Sims is like a universe. The Sims is a universe, and the game The Sims is a part of that universe, along with like SimCity, and like Bustin' Out is kind of in its own category. It just so happens that these games have the same titles sometimes because like The Sims 2 or The Sims 3 on the Nintendo DS is very different from the PC The Sims 2 or Sims 3. So
yeah.
Bustin' Out is kind of like the first one in this lineage, but I fully intend to make you play at least one more of these because I have a lot of thoughts about them. To talk a little bit about my history with The Sims, so I grew up in a family in a divorced parent household. So there were rules for mom's house and rules for dad's house. Dad's house had my stepsister who was super into The Sims, and so we installed The Sims, like the first The Sims, on the computer that we had at my dad's house that was like in my dad's bedroom, and we had to ask special permission to use it. Why we were allowed to fill that thing up with The Sims 1 expansion packs, I do not know. But that was like on weekends when I would be at my dad's house, it was like, we got to play The Sims. And we got up to all kinds of antics, like starving and drowning our people and like normal things that kids do in The Sims. It wasn't until The Sims 2 that I had like access to it at my mom's house and like played it on my own. I was on my sister's computer, but like I could sit down and like really, really play The Sims. But Bustin' Out and The Herbs as well, which I'll talk about in a minute, they were interesting because like I had my Game Boy, so I could play those at any time. And that kind of took me between those two worlds of like, I can only play The Sims sometimes, but I have Bustin' Out all the time. So like Bustin' Out was a big game for me as a child. I would say I probably played more of The Herbs than I did of Bustin' Out, but I played a lot of them because The Herbs is actually a sequel to Bustin' Out, like a direct sequel. Not to say that you had to have finished Bustin' Out to understand what's going on in The Herbs, but there's a lot of stuff in Herbs that I don't feel that you can fully appreciate until you have played Bustin' Out. And I like Herbs better, but you know, you got to start at the beginning. You know, I have to struggle through Dragon Age Origins if I am to play Dragon Age 2. You have to play The Sims Bustin' Out.
I don't feel like you can compare these, but
to enjoy The Herbs, The Sims, and The
Sims. I mean, yeah, the renowned Dragon Age and The Sims Bustin' Out and Game Boy Advance were definitely like in the same category, I imagine.
So I'm very excited. The advice that I will give you to play this game is that if you are having any kind of struggle with it, just turn on the cheat that makes your moods like infinite high and you don't have to maintain them. That is probably the best. Oh, and also there is a cheat that I know this because I replayed this game very, very recently on my phone. Turn on the cheat that lets you get skill points instantly, because that was very nice. But I love The Sims Bustin' Out. I think that it has a great wacky sense of humor, and I'm very, very excited to hear what you think of it.
Okay.
Ask me questions. Yeah, please.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Is this a game that you think stands the test of time enough to play then?
I'd say like 75%, yes.
Okay. And is that coming coming from a perspective of nostalgia, or you've actually looked at it?
Yes, I have actually like looked at it. That's why I replayed it recently. And I think that the writing in it holds up really, really well. I think obviously like it looks like a GBA game. That there's no way around that. And maybe not even a good looking GBA game. I think though that the writing is really, really good. I think that the design of the game is simple in a way, like for the era, like it makes sense that it was designed this way. But I think that if this was a phone game, like a mobile game, like an app that you download, I think that it would absolutely still work, because it is a good format for like, this is a game that I'm playing when I have 10 minutes to sit down and just like bang out a quick mission here or there. I think that it does hold up. I think Herbs holds up better and I like Herbs more. But again, you know, you gotta play them in order.
Oh, goody. Nice trilogy? I don't know.
It's not a trilogy. Unfortunately, there was never an Herbs 2 because of the poor critical and financial performance of those games.
Okay.
Despite me purchasing multiple copies, there was never an Herbs 2.
Oh, so you do actually purchase Sims games, huh?
On occasion. Well, actually, this is a wild one. The story of how I came to play The Herbs was This one time I went to see a movie and we found a copy of The Herbs for the GBA on the floor.
Was this when you were working in the theater?
Nope. This is as a child, and that is how I played The Herbs for the first time, I think. I got a second copy somewhere along the way. I don't think we purchased that first copy of The Herbs. Yes, we found that on the floor of a movie theater.
Oh, so the theater staff did not do a good job of cleaning up then.
It was destiny. I liked
no,
if
actually,
there's
the
no
staff...
other proof of a higher being, it's... a copy of The Herbs, The Sims, and The City from the GBA that I found on a sticky-ass movie theater floor.
I was going to say you sound like you're part of a cult, and you're not helping that. Okay.
Yeah, the cult called Club Exizzle. only true streeties and artsies and nerdsies and richies know what I'm talking about with Club Exizzle.
Okay, sorry. I'm going to try and move this on. So I'm interested because what you've told me is to turn off aspects of the game which make a Sims game. So I'm very curious to see what it's like.
The story is really good.
Okay, I'll definitely take that on board.
I think that there are fun characters. Okay, go on. I'm sorry.
All I was going to say is I find the idea of a handheld, like, at that time, version of The Sims very ambitious in a way.
Yes.
I mean, it's ambitious in the same way of a big company going, we need to get this market. So I'm curious to see how that actually ends up, because most of these GBA like versions, these handheld game versions of the time, felt pretty cash grabby, and the studios who made them were very much not the same, but there were a like conglomerate almost of the same studios that would just keep making games for bigger titles but on the handheld. So yeah, I'm not expecting much from it, but I'm interested to say the least. Because
I think that's a good
way
of
going into it. Who the hell recommends a GBA game to someone? What psychopath would do
that? There are good games on the GBA, first of all, like plenty of like respected games, and then there's also Bustin' Out. But no, I think that you're right. Is that like obviously this started as EA saying like we want to cash in on The Sims as much as possible, and PC gaming is not a big market, so like how can we get this on as many devices as possible?
Yes.
And so like obviously that's the impetus of games like Bustin' Out and The Herbs. But I think that there's something really like fascinating that they found along the way of like taking this impossible task of like how do you take a PC game and put it onto this little fucking handheld. And I think that they came up with something like really, really ingenious and brilliant along the way that I think is worth checking out.
Hmm. Okay. I don't think there's much more I can really ask, because
it's a really straightforward thing. It's like an easy, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's give it a go and see how much I love or hate this thing that you've recommended.
Can't wait.
Is this the oldest thing you've recommended me?
I think so far. I played A Link to the Past.
Fair. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, let's go back to retro. Ooh.
Yes, back in time. Not to give anything away, but time travel is a big part of these games. So.
What?
Hold on to your butt.
Oh, God.